right, I think we're ready for our third case of this morning, United States against Thomas Ross and others. And I have Mr. Clavelli first up.
Thank you very much.
May it please this honorable court, counsel for the government, and my fellow counsel. Your honors, I'm presenting joint issues today on behalf of six young men who have received extremely long sentences. The issues are basically sentencing issues, but they're derived from the inadequacy of the trial evidence to the point where even though this court remanded the matter on the basis of Booker, because at the time of the first sentencing, the guidelines were considered to be mandatory, and the judge did apply them in as advisory, he did not alter any of his earlier findings, and he rejected the government's memorandum on quantity, record 688. He did not rely at all on Ross's, the top defendant, who was responsible for all the drugs, according to the government's theory, on his memorandum on quantity, which were much less than the judge's own findings, which we state in his March 2002 memorandum is totally speculative. Because the 6 months of telephone conversations and the specific deals that were identified by the government and Ross in their sentencing memorandums, which the government says equal 2,200 grams of crack, Ross said is barely over 415 grams of crack. At that time, 1.5 grams, kilos of crack was a level 38, the highest level. The judge totally abandoned, in our view, the evidence of the co-conspirators who testified, the telephone conversations, and went on the basis largely of these drug ledgers and said, I'm going to convert money into drugs. He initially says $20,000 per kilo, which is true, of course, into the 400 and some thousand equals about 22 kilos of powder. He then says the powder was destined to be cooked in the crack, which I don't know why, if it's being cooked in the crack by the purchasers, it should be considered crack being sold by the conspiracy.
But before you get too much further, I want to ask a more general question, because the government, of course, has challenged the scope of your argument, in a sense. They say that they're waivers, and as you well know, and actually every person at defense counsel table knows, this isn't the first Booker remand that we've seen, and it's not the first Palladino or anything else. And a lot of the Booker remands have been treated in the following way. The district court computed what the court computed under the guidelines. Now, you know, of course, we've known this for a while now, but now we know the guidelines are advisory. So the point of the remand wasn't necessarily to recompute the guidelines. Indeed, it wasn't. It was to now bring in the 3553A factors and see whether the sentence advised by the guidelines was a sensible one, including, after Kimbrough, whether the crack powder disparities were something that were thought to be sound. So this district judge muddies that a little bit. He says, on the one hand, we're starting this as a fresh resentencing, obviously, but then he actually does something much more like what I'm describing, it seems. It seems like he just takes his findings from before, and now, recognizing that he has discretion, he adjusts the sentences. So my question for you is, why was that wrong, actually, in the final analysis? Isn't that what our Booker remands call for?
Well, that's sort of why I said the evidence in this case was inadequate for the sentences that were issued. Because he says, well, we're starting with a clean slate, and everybody made mistakes. I made mistakes. The experts didn't distinguish between crack and cocaine base. The arguments of counsel didn't distinguish between crack and cocaine base. The jury verdicts were inadequate. We didn't have any individual findings. But I'm going to take the position, I'm going to assume that the jury, even though they find below 500 grams of powder, it did it because all the powder that was sold was turned into crack.
But isn't that a fairly sensible way to construe this jury's verdict? They think it's less than 500 of powder, but it's a crack conspiracy, so there you go.
You can only do that by ignoring the evidence. Mr. Franklin, one of the co-conspirators, and that's on, the government actually talks about it in its sentencing memo on quantity, I think at page 11, he bought 4 kilos. He admitted buying 4 kilos of powder. So the jury obviously said Mr. Franklin's purchases were not part of the conspiracy because they found under 500 grams of powder. Franklin cooked his own powder in the crack. So apparently the jury dismissed Franklin as being a member of the conspiracy. And when you look at the drug ledger, the government wasn't able to identify the names on the drug ledger, and several defense counsel got up and said, well, you don't see my client on there. So members... people who are appellants were not even listed in the drug ledger. So it was really very inadequate. And then, I might add, the government said over the 6 months, 2 kilos of powder, of crack was distributed. That's one-third kilo per month using the government's figures. And the judge said one-half kilo per month. And that difference all by itself would affect the sentencing of 4 of these appellants.
Before we get, counsel, any deeper into the weeds and the merits of the drug quantity determination here, there's another additional sort of a waiver argument that's being made here beyond the scope of the remand and what was properly within that scope, and that is that this drug quantity determination was never challenged in the initial appeal when this case was here the first time.
Because of a change in the law. It's no longer 1.5 kilos, which everybody pretty much was stuck with. It was 4.5 kilos at the time of sentencing for a level 38. And then, of course, Kimbrough came down, which is another intervening case, and the judge clearly felt he was stuck with Seventh Circuit case law, which wasn't changed until U.S. versus Taylor.
The drug type was never challenged in the first appeal.
Drug type?
We didn't challenge drug quantity, drug type.
No, because Edwards hadn't been decided yet, and Edwards is another intervening case that came down after the initial sentencings. So that's when everybody said, hey, cocaine base is not crack.
No, I mean, we had prior decisions that had said much the same thing. Actually, I think it was a different Booker case. As far as I know, not related. But
it was a different Booker case, yes.
Yeah, that's my recollection. And so, yes, I mean, Edwards came along and said again, you know, that there's cocaine base and there's crack and, you know, are these really different?
As the judge pointed out, everybody did make some mistakes, but it's the appellants who are suffering.
But everybody talked about crack throughout this trial.
Interchangeably, right? With cocaine base, that's correct.
Right, and so isn't the only reasonable assumption, recognizing as well that it's sentencing, the judge is making sentencing findings of fact, if you will, that when everybody uses the term cocaine base interchangeably with crack, it's the crack form of cocaine base. In fact, the judge, if I remember, a couple of times says nobody's talking about free basing here, nobody's talking about, you know, other pastes or, you know,
right. All
of that stuff.
Well, Your Honor is right, Dan. And possibly Judge Gelman was correct when he said using the harmless error analysis from Williams and everything. But how do you explain that when you come down to the verdict? It's simply not a decision by the jury in this case. The verdict form was totally inadequate. And you cannot fill these gaps.
What relevance is the verdict to the sentencing, given that the sentence could have even been based on acquitted conduct? Why are we tethered to the verdict as strongly as you think we are?
Because it's the issue of sentencing. And the judge felt bound by the, in my opinion, the advisory guidelines, He says it over and over again. The law is the law. The commission, even though they know there's a disparity, they only reduce it to 80%. Judge Gelman basically came right out and said it. Maybe we'll be back. Because maybe there will be further changes. And so it's clear if you were to send it back to him, he would say, I would take another look based on the different ratio.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Duesberger, are you arguing now?
May it please the court, my name is Roger Duesberger. I represent Juan Hernandez. In 2002, 19 months after trial ended, the district court sentenced Mr. Hernandez to 360 months based on a drug quantity level of 38, which he enhanced two levels to 40 for weapons possession. In 2008, nearly 7 years after trial, the court resentenced Hernandez to the same 360 months based on its same 2002 findings. The court's drug quantity determination was based on two findings. One, Hernandez regularly bought marijuana and crack and powder cocaine from Thomas Ross. And two, he was a leader of an MLD gang section.
On the big picture here, the six defendants here, five of them had their sentences reduced when it went back, all except your client. What was different about your client than everybody else?
The only difference in the case was during the course of time, he had pled guilty in state court to second-degree murder, which was...
That's a slight difference.
Right. A killing in the unreasonable belief of self-defense.
This is Mr. Santiago that he had attempted to kill a few weeks before and then does, in fact.
This incident came in the context of Hernandez's brother and cousin being murdered by the gang and Santiago having attempt, pardon?
The brother.
Bum, little bum.
Bum and little bum.
Well,
your client is bum.
Right. And he's had that name since childhood. It's not a gang name. But at any rate, his cousin was killed, or his brother was killed the day he was released from jail in 1998. And several months later, his cousin was killed. And Santiago, the evidence was that Santiago had tried to kill Mr. Hernandez. So apparently he was wary of Santiago. An incident occurred. And he believed he was going to be killed, and the evidence was that he pled guilty to second-degree murder, was sentenced to 12 and a half years concurrent with his federal conviction and sentence. The district court never identified the weapon on which it based its weapons enhancement in this case. In 2002, the court indicated that the drug conspiracy was a Ross conspiracy, not a gang conspiracy. In 2008, it said specifically at Hernandez's sentencing, the theory was that this was a Ross conspiracy, not a gang conspiracy, and I made that distinction.
But your argument about Mr. Hernandez seems to focus on the fact that he may not have been actively involved in the actual commercial part of the conspiracy, the sales of whatever, marijuana, cocaine, crack. But there was a lot of evidence that he was involved in the conspiracy, kind of the muscle of the conspiracy. He was out there enforcing.
Well, the district court found that it was a Ross conspiracy, not a gang conspiracy. So.
Oh, and the district court tries to be pretty careful about not equating the gang with the conspiracy, but he finds that Hernandez is a leader in this conspiracy.
Well, a leader of one of 26 sections of the gang is what the judge found. We dispute that. We have argued in our briefs before the district court and this court that there's no evidence that Hernandez was a section leader or a co-section leader. His brother, David Hernandez, was the section leader at Rockwell and Potomac. There were meetings, gang meetings held. Juan Hernandez was not at the meetings. That was the testimony of the government witness. So we contend that there's no evidence that he was a gang leader. He had been incarcerated in the state system from 94 to 98.
No, but unfortunately, we know that that may not preclude the fact that he's still a gang member.
Oh, he was...
Or involved with this conspiracy, for that matter. But
right, but there was no evidence that he did anything while he was in jail to enhance or further the aims of the conspiracy. The majority of the government's evidence was their taped calls. And in the taped calls, Hernandez is only heard on six occasions buying or possibly buying what clearly seems to be marijuana. The government admitted many of these calls were marijuana calls. There's only one...
Kind of wrap up.
Okay. Finally, we point out that the court in 2008 at Mr. Hernandez's resentencing failed to rule on his arguments. The court just said, I've made my quantity findings, that's behind us, but he meant that was behind us in 2002.
Okay, I think we have the point. So thank you very much. Mr. Eldon.
May it please the court, I'm Barry Eldon on behalf of the United States. Regarding the drug quantity issue, the judge did not say that he was basing that decision solely on the drug ledgers. He, in his opinion, he's very clear that he bases that decision on multiple sources of evidence. For example, the tape-recorded conversations, the wiretaps. That's part of it.
You mean his old finding? I mean, he does say in the new sentencing, the resentencing, there have been findings made, for instance, in quantity already and the fact that this is crack cocaine. So those are issues behind us.
Yes, he says that. I believe you're quoting from Mr. Ross's sentencing, the very beginning.
Probably, yeah.
At the very beginning, that's what he says. And Mr. Ross, what the judge did, as your Honor is aware, is that he sentenced each of these six defendants separately.
Right.
It was all in one day. He started with Mr. Ross, and right at the beginning, he started with Mr. Ross, and he said, and that is behind it. What he was referring to there, Your Honor, is a July 19th, 2007 hearing. What the judge did, it says, well, let's resolve some of these issues prior to the sentencing of the individual defendants. So I will determine drug quantity and drug type, which was an issue. And he did so on July 19th. So he got that out of the way. And so when he started the proceedings on the day of the sentencing of the individual defendants, he says, okay, those issues are behind us. Nevertheless, he heard out all of the attorneys regarding any issue, including drug quantity. He let them argue whatever they wanted to argue. He didn't cut them off. And if they could persuade the judge to change his mind, sometimes judges change their minds, that could have happened. His mind was not changed, but that reference is to the July 19th. And on July 19th, he basically says, I'm sticking with the findings that I had previously made.
One of the things that I worried about a little bit looking at things the judge said was whether he fully appreciated the discretion he now has after Kimbrough. He keeps talking about whether there should be a disparity between crack and powder, and Kimbrough gave him a lot of discretion. I'm not sure that he reflects that.
Your Honor, this case came down shortly after Kimbrough was decided.
Right.
The parties briefed it. The judge was well aware that he could depart from the guidelines based on Kimbrough. And what he says, but I understand Your Honor's point, because throughout the proceedings he makes comments like, the law is the law, I'm going to follow the law,
right,
et cetera, et cetera.
Worries me about it.
Yes, but Judge, if you go back again to those first couple pages of the Ross hearing, where he basically sets the parameters of what's going to happen that particular day, and he says on page 4, and I think you were on page 3. Now if you go on page 4 of Ross's transcript, the way that started out, I asked the court, do I assume for purposes of my argument, he told me to go first, and I said, do I assume for purposes of the argument that the guidelines for Mr. Ross are the guidelines in the pre-sentence report? I don't have to address those any further. And then so he said at this point on page 4, now, Mr. Clavelli raised arguments why he thinks those guidelines are wrong. That's the law as it is today. The court, as far as the guideline computation, I'm not varying from the law as it stands today or the statute as it stands today. But, of course, we have to guide ourselves by the primary sources, Section 3553A, and those are very important. And so, in other words, what he's saying is, so far as the guideline computation, the law is the law, I'm sticking to the law. But you can argue whatever you want to argue, and I'll hear you. And he did that.
The judge never directly addressed the Kimbrough discretion issue, though. And as you've noted, it was briefed and brought to the judge's attention, right?
Right. And the way it was argued, Your Honor, in the district court by defense counsel, and I'm thinking in particular, well, I can't remember which one, but when they did argue it, they would point out the disparity, and they would argue that this is unjust. This is an unjust disparity. It's an unjust sentence. And the court recognized, the district court recognized that on 3553A, one of the objectives of sentencing is to impose a just sentence. And, for example, with Mr. Ross, Mr. Ross's guidelines called for a life sentence. It is not 360 to life, which is life. And the judge said, I'm not going to impose that because that would be unjust. And the court recognized that one of the factors under 3553A is imposing a just sentence. And that's how it was argued to the court. The court was aware of it, and the court took into consideration a lot of factors, including the disparity, and all of the arguments that were made by counsel, and reached his conclusions.
Right, so as to the issue of a policy disagreement with the ratio, the crack powder ratio, the judge really never did address that directly, and there's all of this, you know, the law is the law, I'm bound by the law as it stands now, all sprinkled throughout his sentencing remarks, and then the closest that he came to addressing it was a statement that he was uncomfortable with a disparity and something should be done, and I hope the nation wakes up, but right now the law is the law and I'm enforcing it the way it's written, and it's a sad decision that I have to make. I mean, it sounds like he harbored a policy disagreement with the ratio, but misunderstood that he could vary the sentence as a result of that.
Well, Judge, I think that has to be taken into the context of what he said in the very beginning of the day when Mr. Ross was being sentenced. And he said that so far as the guideline computation is concerned, the law is the law, and I'm sticking with the law. And he went on further, and by the way, at the end of Mr. Cortez's sentencing, he commented about how he treated the guidelines, and what he said is, you know, I treat the guidelines as a starting point. I don't presume they are correct, he says, because I'm not supposed to do that, and I don't presume they are correct, but that is my starting point. And so he used the guidelines as a starting point, and he said that's the way I do it. So if the guidelines were changed, and by the way, I think the context here again is that these sentencings occurred right after the amendment of the guidelines for the crack amendments. So he was well aware of that, and he had mentioned that he had been getting, you know, motions under 3582 for reduction of sentence, and he was well aware of that. Now, normally, resentencings are based on the law, the original law, but he sentenced based on the amended guidelines. They were retroactive anyway, so that was the right thing to do, and the government agreed. So that changed the guidelines from what they were, and somewhat, it didn't help most of these defendants because they were so off the charts in terms of quantity, but it did ameliorate to some extent the 100-to-1 ratio. It's not 100-to-1 ratio. But he was aware of that. And he was aware that there are other proposals to change the guidelines further and change the statute further. And if that was done, then that would make a definite change for him, because the statute gives him the parameters and the guidelines are the starting point. So I think it's clear that for the computation, the law is the law, and he was going to stick to that. But he would consider all of these arguments under 3553A. And with respect to drug quantity and drug type, the drug quantity, as I said, is based on multiple sources. And if you look even at the ledger, based on the testimony, this accounts receivable ledger was over $400,000 accounts receivable on the last day.
It's a lot of money, but I have to say I was reading one part of the transcript where this discussion about wholesale quantities versus retail quantities was going on, and not for the first time I've thought, you know, that it's lucky you don't need to do too much math as a lawyer, because, you know, the quantity that you would get if you thought $20,000 corresponded to a kilo is quite different from the quantity you would get if you thought $100,000 corresponds to a kilo, if what you know is the dollar amount. You know, you're only going to get 4 kilos if you have $400,000 and it's 100 a pop because it's retail. Obviously, retail is higher than the wholesale price.
Well, there was testimony, Your Honor, for example, from Mr. Franklin, that, you know, based on the amount he paid Mr. Ross. I mean, that's testimony that I think the district court can rely on, and which would have amounted to, if you multiply it out, is $20,000 per kilo. So
your position is these were wholesale transactions, so it was appropriate to use
that's
the wholesale,
right.
The ledger, I suppose.
Yes, that is correct. And you have the testimony from Mr. Franklin. I mean, it's certainly reasonable for the district court to rely on the testimony. But there was more than that. There was $260,000 either seized or discussed on the tapes. There was testimony by the cooperating witness, so there was ample amount of evidence. And regarding drug type, there were 11 witnesses who testified, four drug dealers, 7 police officers. They all said this was crack. Government expert actually testified on behalf of the defense. He was called by the defense, and he said, "What I'm talking about here, when I say crack, and I say cocaine base, they mean the same thing." So
the government's theory is that this particular conspiracy went from what, 1997 through the time of the indictment,
in or about 1990.
Oh.
Through June of 1999, and for example, there was evidence regarding Mr. Hernandez being involved in activities even before 1990, which really would be either relevant conduct or part of the conspiracy, in which, for example, he was setting up security, which involved a gun, for one of their retail drug outlets. And if I could just briefly comment on the Hernandez issues, in terms of the drug amount, there was abundant evidence that he was involved in more than just marijuana. I mean, there's evidence, direct evidence by Mr. Ramon, who testifies that he sees Hernandez take powder cocaine and mix it with baking soda and creating crack. He was making crack. And in addition, in one of the late calls, he calls up Mr. Ross and he asks for 4.5 cooked. That's 4.5 ounces of crack cooked. So he was dealing in crack. And
you don't have all that much direct evidence, though, about Mr. Isn't most of your evidence from Mr. Hernandez the notion that this is relevant conduct? It was reasonably, the acts of others were reasonably foreseeable to him?
It's reasonably foreseeable to him that, but he was still actively participating and had actively participated for about 10 years. I mean, for example, in call 2, Roman numeral 2, 1364, Ross talks about at one particular retail drug outlet, which he calls the zone. He says, "Bum and others, that's Bum and others be hanging there," and he goes on to say, "The business, we together." In other words, the business, the drug business, he's together with Bum, that is Juan Hernandez, at that particular location. That's in 1998. So his leadership role in the drug conspiracy continued, and he was one of the founders of the drug conspiracy. Ross says that over 10 years ago, and with respect to the gun, he set up the practice of using security. He was caught with a gun and drugs in a car. He gave Roman a gun to store. He murdered Carlito Santiago with a gun, and the reason for the murder is clear in the tape. It was that Carlito Santiago was challenging the leadership of the conspiracy, and he said that we're going to take over a new generation, and I'm thinking in particular called V3555, and that's why he was murdered with a gun. So Hernandez had a gun. And as indicated, the district court gave Mr. Hernandez a fair hearing. He gave him a very substantial sentence, but he said, by considering the mitigating, to do this, it breaks my heart to do that. This judge gave every consideration to all of these defendants, imposed reasonable sentences after fair hearings, and therefore we ask the court to affirm.
All right, thank you. I'm not sure how much time people had left. I think, Mr. Clavel, you have a minute, and Mr. Duesberger, I will give you a minute as well if you want it.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, it seems to me that the argument the government is presenting today to sustain these sentences is different than the argument it presented in the district court, and even in the briefs where it said the remand was simply because the guidelines are now advisory. It's clear that when the judge made his comments at Appendix 60 of our brief, that the changes, the very slight changes made by the commission, where they went from 100 to 1 to 80 to 1, doesn't really help this defendant. And that defendant, Hernandez, well, he had 13 kilos. Two had 13 kilos. The other four, though, 6 kilos down to 2 kilos. So the quantity actually will help four of these 6 defendants go below offense level 38. Now, it's clear that since Taylor and Blake hadn't been decided yet, the judge was under the opinion that he could not make a policy decision disagreement with the crack guidelines, because that's what the Seventh Circuit at that time was telling the district judge. And he said it specifically. I am bound by the law as it stands today. And so it can't be any more clear, Your Honors. He felt bound at that time. He said, I'm unhappy. He says, I hope the nation wakes up to that. Right now, the law is the law. Again, that's Appendix page 60. And it's simply that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Duesberger?
This conspiracy was extremely amorphous. The district court found that the government only proved a single conspiracy starting in 1998 when Ross was released from jail and was getting supplies of huge quantities of drugs from this Manny Baltazar. So it really only went from 98 to 99. The arrests were made. And in the meantime, Hernandez was in jail himself and was not participating in this. The incident about the cooking, there's no evidence that that was connected to the Ross conspiracy. B.D. West, a black disciple, showed Hernandez, the evidence was, how to cook crack, and then Hernandez did it himself. But there's no evidence that was connected to the Ross conspiracy. There's law, I believe, that conspirators, members of conspiracies, can do drug deals on their own that are not part of the conspiracy. And I believe if Hernandez was involved in this cooking incident, that was outside the conspiracy. Carlito Santiago already was second in command of the drug gang. So he was not trying to take anything over. He was already in command. There was a vendetta against the Hernandez family. And, in fact, the district court judge even found that gang leadership is irrelevant to defendants Gonzalez and Pittman. Gonzalez was the...
All right. I think that we see the point, Mr. Duesberger. So thank you very much. Our appreciation to all counsel. We understand you took these cases by appointment. The court is assisted very much by your efforts. Thank you. And thanks to the government.